From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If one goal of the war in Iraq, according to the Bush administration, is to redefine Mideast politics, the U.S. may be getting more than it bargained for. Martin Walker, chief correspondent for United Press International, says that the war and the emerging Arabic media are fueling an explosion of pan-Arabism unseen in 40 years. He joins me now from Kuwait City. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Hello there.
So the Arab governments, to one degree or another, are mainly in support of the coalition in this war. But the Arab street seems to be very anti-war and anti-Western. Tell me what you're seeing in the press.
What I'm seeing is the creation, or the recreation for the first time since Nasser in the 1950s and 1960s, of a real pan-Arab nationalist patriotic consciousness. And I'm seeing this not just in traditional leftist papers or papers of radical governments, but even in the newspapers of America's friends. When you read in Al-Akhbar, which one knows to be a semi-official newspaper in Egypt, the evil axis of Bush and the evil forces will not gain their main political objective from the war to crush the Arabs. The Arabs are rising. It's really quite extraordinary. I mean, I was looking at Al-Riyad, which is the official Saudi government daily. Now, the Saudi government, we all know, is secretly being very helpful to the war, but this is its editorial. It's a surprising historical paradox that the most modern civilization is fighting the most ancient human civilization with false arguments in an attempt to vie for its resources. It's a kind of a mood of contempt for the West and its supposed hypocrisy and real patriotic flood of support behind the Iraqis.
It's interesting how these state organs or semi-official state organs are being used as a means for these governments to play both ends against the middle, in grudging degrees supporting the United States in the war, and on the other hand, to deal with their own internal problems by criticizing the United States and the war for public consumption. Is that the purpose of these editorials?
A month ago, I'd have said yes. I'd have said this is part of the traditional Arab game through which authoritarian Arab regimes, which like to stay in close contact with the West, allow a kind of a safety valve to their people. But this is something new. When, for example, in Egypt, Al-Waft, which is quite a popular newspaper, when it starts in a front-page editorial writing herograms to, I quote, "the Iraqis' steadfastness and their brave resistance is noble and gallant, the pride of us Arabs, the pride of us all, an inspiration to us all." I mean, that rocks me back on my heels a bit. It's as though this is not simply a war against Iraq. It's now a war against the Arabs as a whole.
You invoked Gamal Abdel Nasser and a sort of neo-pan-Arabism that seems to have emerged as a result of this war. Is there any reflection in any of these pieces that you're seeing to how catastrophic pan-Arabism was for the various Arab cultures?
Absolutely not. No, there's no assessment of what, in retrospect, a dark era for human rights and for Arab economic development, the pan-Arabist period of the Nasser era was. And I think we're in for something extraordinary in the Arab world. I'd always assumed that this new Arab independent media were going to have quite an effect upon internal Arab politics. Now it seems that they're building something rather more powerful. And we're no longer just talking about an Al Jazeera effect. The Arab airwaves are now absolutely blanketed with these so-called independent TV satellite channels. You've got one out of Abu Dhabi. You've got Al Arabiya, a brand new one coming out of Dubai. The Hezbollah movement in Lebanon's got its own satellite channel, Al Manar. And all of these TV channels are heroizing, not Saddam Hussein as much as the Iraqi resistance. And they are hailing these Iraqi guerrillas as the heroes of the entire Arab people.
So do you think it's the pan-Arab cable channels that have in fact cultivated this pan-Arab consciousness, or would this have happened absent Al Jazeera and the like?
I don't think it would have happened absent Al Jazeera and so on, and they in turn wouldn't have happened without the way in which a new pan-Arab press began to emerge in London over the last 10 years, because that kind of free press couldn't emerge anywhere within the Arab world. It had to start in London. But I think there's something else unique to the television, and that is the way in which they are covering this war in much the same way that they covered the Intifada, the Palestinian-Israeli war, which is to say the glorification of martyrs, which is to say a kind of a blood pornography, a lingering of the TV cameras upon scenes of extraordinary carnage and bloodshed, scenes of dead civilians, of flowing blood that for reasons of taste are never seen or so very seldom seen on Western televisions. And it's creating a kind of, I can only call it a media blood cult. It's pretty much all you see.
All right, Martin. Keep your head down. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Martin Walker, chief correspondent for United Press International, joined us from Kuwait City.
For the last month, we've been keeping tabs on NPR's John Burnett, embedded with the 1st Marine Division. Currently, they're at their 3rd Command headquarters in Iraq, somewhere between the Euphrates River and Baghdad. When we spoke on Thursday, he said that as the war heats up, his division commanders have become increasingly stingy with logistical information, and tension has developed between the reporters and the Marines.
Let me give you a prime example of this. Mm-hmm. There was an incident between a Christian Science Monitor reporter and the Marines. He was in a convoy on the highway headed north toward Baghdad, and they started coming under mortar fire. This was a unilateral journalist, a freelancer. He was not embedded, but the Marines, you know, had invited him to go along with this convoy. So he stops, and he was apparently stringing for CNN. He gets on his satellite phone and calls CNN and start saying, here we are on this and such highway, this many miles south of Baghdad, heading in this direction with this Marine unit, and this is happening to us, and this is being broadcast simultaneously on CNN, which is being monitored by the U.S. military, and they freaked. They sent a Humvee screeching out there on the highway within 30 minutes of his broadcasting live from this battle zone. He was being taken in to, quote, see the colonel. He was kicked out of the theater. And I think it tells you just how hypersensitive the military is about, you know, giving away any information that can be construed as giving away their position.
When you're asking for information and not receiving it, do you take it on faith that they have good reasons to deny you that information, or do you think they've gone overboard?
I think it's the same old Pentagon routine of just telling you as much as they want to tell you and not telling you anymore. We're getting somewhat more in the field, but still it's the same people and we're the same journalists, and we've just moved the entire press conference into a combat zone. So yes, it has gotten very frustrating this last week for all of us, all five of the journalists here.
So you aren't getting the information that you think you ought to be able to get. The tension is riding high. The access, even while you're sitting there, seems to be limited. Do you have some questions then about what your role is vis-a-vis the military or what the Pentagon seems to believe your role to be?
Well, all along, this has been, the Pentagon is using us and we're using them. We're using them because war is an incredible story. It's the ultimate story, and we want to tell that story, and that's why we're here. But it's becoming very apparent also that, I mean, we are clearly being used by the Pentagon, and in some cases for propaganda purposes. And let me give you an example. We talked with the head of the intelligence section a week or so ago, and he was telling us all about the fearsome firepower that the Marines were going to bring to bear in this battle, and how, you know, they were going to overwhelm their opponents with air power and ground forces and really send a message to Baghdad that it's pointless to fight. And I commented, it sounds to me like you're using the journalist as your mouthpiece for this. And he said, you know, well, yes, we are. At this point, John Kiffner with the New York Times, who's with us, just kind of leans back in his chair and says, I think I'm getting queasy. So there's that sort of covert use of us. And then also, it's kind of an ongoing commercial for the U.S. Marine Corps. We sat down with Captain Joe Plensler, who's sort of in charge of the embeds for the Marines. And he was showing me all these color pictures in Time magazine showing the Marines preparing for war and all the bold-faced quotes. She was so pleased because it was this amazing advertisement for the U.S. Marine Corps that money can't buy. And so at the same time that, you know, we're covering a war, you know, we're also giving them, you know, that publicity. But also understand that they're taking a chance in letting the journalists in here. There are a lot of, you know, old guard Marine officers who don't think we belong here. So it's a very sensitive thing that the Marines are doing within their own culture as well. I want to stress that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. In order to bring this slice of the story to your listeners, you've had to reconcile the various roles you're being made to play, either willy-nilly or in the course of doing your job. You are a reporter, reporting on what goes right and what goes wrong. You're also a tool of propaganda, inadvertently, and the provider of free advertising, not you specifically, but obviously all the embedded reporters. You know, I think that all the news outlets have decided that this is a compromise well worth making in order to bring this story to Americans. From where you stand, do you agree?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I still think that it's a trade-off that's worth making because I'm getting ready to get closer to the front and to the action and to talk to some of the guys who are actually doing the fighting, and I wouldn't be able to get that close otherwise. I know that because there's two carloads of journalists, freelancers sitting on the highway about 200 yards from me right now who can't get to the front, and I will be able to. And it's a great story, and I want to be there, and I want to tell that story. I mean, anyway, Brooke, I mean, every journalist who works in the culture of news knows it. I mean, we're constantly used. We're used by press flags. We're used by City Hall. We're used by congressional aides. You know, everybody who sits in a press section who does public relations is using us. We have to be completely aware of that, and we still have to, you know, get out a legitimate story and know that we're being spun. It's the same game. It's just played rather elaborately out here in a war zone.
And with higher stakes.
With much higher stakes, you betcha.
And so basically, as you go about the news-gathering job, do you contend with the same kind of queasiness that Jonathan Kiffner expressed?
I'm mindful that parts of what I'm reporting serve the interests of the war planners, and that gives me pause. But it's also happening. It's news. The Marines preparing for war with their firepower is one of the things that's happening here. And so I report that, knowing they want me to report that.
You can live with this as long as what you're reporting is the truth.
That's right. I think you just said it much more succinctly and importantly than I did.
Thanks a lot, John.
Talk to you later.
Bye. NPR's John Burnett is embedded with the 1st Marine Command Division in Iraq.
Coming up, how the war plays on the small screen and how a TV drama series looks increasingly like reality.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, bringing you the soundtrack of war. It's been dubbed reality war, real-time battles with real-time pictures. But a picture can mean anything, depending on who's watching.
Basra has been the focus of a lot of attention, and there were concerns that a humanitarian disaster could be provoked. But, John, look at this, little children and the soldiers giving them candy.
A survey conducted last weekend by CNN, USA Today, and Gallup found that 90% of pro-war Americans believe themselves well-served by the coverage. Among those who opposed the war, 60% were satisfied. That generally good opinion, however, had already started to slide between Saturday and Sunday, when the picture of the invincible coalition forces grew tattered under fire. Still, overall, the TV coverage, dominated by the embedding of hundreds of reporters with military units, seems to be working for the news outlets and millions of news viewers, and especially for generals. like Major General Victor Renouart.
In terms of bringing the media onto the battlefield, I think this has been really an historic event.
And Brigadier General Vince Brooks.
We have embedded media so that the truth does come out.
And General Tommy Franks.
I'm a fan of it. I think it was a very good thing to do.
The Pentagon's uniform delight should give pause to anyone aware of the history of war. The power of the press has been regarded as a challenge to military operations since the charge of the Light Brigade, and the Pentagon still believes critical reporting of Vietnam sapped the nation's will to fight. But the Pentagon was unhappy that its successes in the first Gulf War went unchronicled, and so this time it put reporters in the field of battle. Some went native immediately, like CNN's embedded reporter Walter Rogers, heard on NPR's Morning Edition Thursday. Notice the personal pronoun.
So we pulled back for that, and as I say, when we were pulling back, we could see the area we had fought through 2.5 days ago, when it was called Machine Gun Alley, and when we pulled back, there were lots of dead Iraqis.
The Pentagon officers who'd conceived and advanced the embedded program should step forward and demand a fourth star for their epaulette.
Jack Schaefer writes the Press Box column for Slate.com. He says that the embedded reporters provided a steady stream of positive press in the early stages of the war, but as the news grows grimmer, it's unclear whether the Pentagon will stay pleased. The military, however, has covered its flanks with other embeds of a different sort in TV newsrooms, retired generals.
There's no parallel anywhere in journalism to what the TV generals are doing. In many cases, the TV generals seem to have staged this sort of passive coup of the television newscast.
I think the armchair generals, as I choose to call them, have provided a level of military analysis which I find quite interesting as a viewer.
Chris Kramer is in charge of CNN International, which operates CNN's channels overseas. He says it would be unfair to judge the coverage on the basis of one evening or one week or even one month, because the story is unfolding at breakneck speed.
There are people in control rooms here who are making second-to-second decisions about which particular story they're including. And I stress, there's no textbook for any of this. You know, there isn't some wise person sitting in control rooms making every single call and having the wonderful benefit of hindsight.
One decision was to run only brief, relatively tame bits of the grisly footage of killed and captured American soldiers broadcast all over the world by Al Jazeera and other networks.
Journalists will have a series of intellectual debates about how you depict the horror of war, how you depict the horror of death. You can put it on unedited and let the audience make their own mind up, which is what some broadcasters choose to do, but not from the civilized journalistic world that I'm used to, certainly not from the BBC that I'm used to, not from the CNN that I'm used to.
There was an interesting argument on ABC, live of course, between anchor Charles Gibson and embedded reporter and anchor Ted Koppel. Gibson defended the decision not to run the footage. Koppel disagreed. Alex Jones, director of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press at Harvard, stands with Koppel. He says, show it, not incessantly, but once or perhaps twice, and make the Iraqis' treatment of POWs part of the record of this war.
I think that the fact that they were abusing was news, and I think that's something that should have been reported as news. I think that the American public should be able to see what people in other parts of the world see.
Increasingly, news consumers are going to the foreign media via the internet or satellite TV to fill in the blanks. Jamal Dajani, director of Middle East programming for WorldLink TV, says that contrary to popular belief, access is much better over there.
All what you have to do is just go to Beirut or go to a high building in Cairo and look at the rooftops. You will see thousands and thousands of satellite television that makes everything accessible to them, from European TV to even American television. They can watch CNN right there in their living rooms in Cairo or in Baghdad or in Saudi Arabia.
In America, he says, there's too much coverage broadcast from hotel rooftops in Kuwait and not enough from the Arab street. And he offers a solution, a free flow of information among networks, using each other's reporters, airing each other's reports, political spin be damned.
You can either stop the flow of information, period, and say, well, we don't trust the Arab journalists and they're saying the same thing. Or you can leave it to the listeners and say they are intelligent enough to determine what is propaganda and what is not.
As it turned out, on the very evening I spoke to Tijani, CNN had an hour-long interview with a bureau chief from Abu Dhabi Television, and ABC's Nightline offered two reports from the Arab street.
There was a stampede when the Kuwaiti Red Crescent showed up with 20,000 meals, all under the protection of U.S. Marines and British troops. And although at least one reporter on the scene was overheard phoning in a live report about how the Iraqis were dancing with joy, they were not dancing, and it was not joyful.
The metaphor most applied to the coverage of the war in Iraq is that of a jigsaw puzzle that has to be assembled in small pieces. We also have to factor in the fog of war. Was there a popular uprising in Basra or not? Did U.S. troops uncover a chemical factory or not? And when exactly did U.S. troops take the port of Qasr? There's a tendency to rush to judgment in first reports from the field. And it may be that this is the worst war coverage ever, except for the coverage of virtually every other war in recent times. Alex Jones.
I look at it against what happened in the Persian Gulf the first time, what happened in Grenada, what happened in Panama, what happened in Afghanistan. And I consider it to be a great improvement over any of those, simply because the military has allowed the reporters to have access to the front. I think that's an enormous step, and I think it's something that has made the entire process of reporting more honest.
And frankly, more thrilling, at least to anyone who was tuned to CNN at 1 a.m. last Sunday and saw a live firefight between U.S. Marines and Iraqi snipers near Qasr. CNN's Chris Kramer watched it and...
I thought as I drove home that night that, you know, no longer would many children around the world have to ask their fathers what they did in the war, because in one way they could actually witness it on television. And that's when I realized that television news had made a paradigm shift.
Television news outlets have been plagued with charges of jingoism, of strategic omission, of over-reliance on embeds and ex-generals. But the coverage is already evolving, changing, one hopes, for the better. And meanwhile, TV viewers have an astonishingly close-up and personal first draft of history.
If embedded reporters prove to be unreliable in promoting the war, the Pentagon has far more dependable tools for shaping public perception of military campaigns. When the phrase Operation Iraqi Freedom first appeared at the bottom of TV screens, it was simply another effort to hammer home the administration's stated mission of liberation. But this Madison Avenue approach to branding war is a relatively recent invention. Joining us for a look back at the Pentagon's name game is Professor Conrad Crane, director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute. Professor Crane, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
When exactly did the Defense Department start actually naming its operations?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the Germans started putting specific names on operations in World War One, but the United States really didn't start doing it to World War Two. At that point, the operational names were basically a classified name for an operation, but enabled different planners and officers and different participants to talk about an operation without giving too much away. But beginning in Korea with Matt Ridgway, he started naming his operations to give a little boost to the troops as well. And so he'd like to name his operations things like Killer and Ripper, because he thought it kind of inspired the troops and showed the attitude that he wanted them to have, because he was concerned about the fighting spirit of his army.
Operation Killer. Now, how did that name play on the home front, or was the home front even aware of Operation Killer?
Well, the home front became aware of Operation Killer, and there were complaints from General Ridgway's superiors in Washington that didn't like the name because it sounded too belligerent and it wouldn't play well in the public relations, and didn't affect Ridgway. He maintained that name.
Well, when did the bell go off that said, aha, we can help manage public opinion by cunningly naming these operations explicitly for public consumption?
It seems to me to be much more a 1990s and later phenomenon, where you really start to think about the name that's going to play well on the world stage.
Tell me the mechanism for developing these names. Is there a naming directorate somewhere in the Pentagon?
The name for an operation normally comes from whatever group of staff officers is in charge of developing it. It gets vetted at a lot of different levels, however, depending how important the operation is. High-visibility operations get a lot of attention on their names.
Now, the government has its name for this war, Operation Iraqi Freedom, but the networks have various other brand names for the war, attack on Iraq, strike on Iraq, and so forth. Is the Pentagon in competition with the networks to come up with the catchiest moniker? Do they concern themselves with how the private sector will do its own naming?
Well, obviously, there's a concern about how these names are going to play on the outside. You could see that with the initial name for the war on terrorism, which I believe was Infinite Justice, and then they realized very quickly that that was going to have some problems in the Arab world, and they quickly changed it to Enduring Freedom. But overall, the concern, I think, is more that it doesn't cause problems externally, but at the same time, it sends a message internally as well. And I think that the Iraqi Freedom has been very successful in communicating to the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines involved in this operation what their real overall mission is.
These names seem to be somewhat transitory. For example, Operation Desert Storm has long since mutated into simply being the Gulf War, or now the First Gulf War.
Well, I think it depends on who is talking about it. I know within the military, Desert Storm is still a very commonly used term, but normally the public is a little less comfortable with these operational code names and comes up with some other name for wars. So I would expect that that same pattern will probably hold true.
So what's your favorite operation name, the one that has the most resonance for you?
I mean, I like Urgent Fury. I think it really it sends a great message. Desert Storm is played very well within the Army. I mean, it really gives a sense of the it leads to a lot of similes and metaphors about the application of military force in that war that have been very, very graphic. So that one, there's a certain almost literary quality to that one.
Whereas, for example, maybe in this war, Operation Dangerously Long Supply Lines, probably, you know, that probably wouldn't play.
No, that probably would not play.
All right. Well, Conrad Crane, thank you very much.
Okay.
Professor Conrad Crane is director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute. He joins us from the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Sometimes art, if you could call a Fox primetime TV show art, can resemble life in unsettling ways. The show in question here is called 24, which portrays the life and trials of counterterrorist agent Jack Bauer in real time, hour by hour. 24 episodes of 24 make up one very long, very dangerous day. The first 12 episodes of Jack's Day have had him foiling the attempts of evildoers to explode a nuclear bomb in Los Angeles. Through splendid detective work and a little bit of torture, the bomb was found and flown to the Mojave Desert, where it did explode, mushroom cloud and all. And even though it was fiction, in a code orange world, it was chilling. Then the show went dark for a couple of weeks, as was the production plan, and the U.S. went to war in Iraq. This week, 24 came back with a new episode in which the president must decide how to retaliate for the bomb. It seems that it may have been the work of one terrorist group or three unnamed Middle Eastern countries. Fox tells us that the episode was in the can before the real war started, but wow, did it resonate. James Poniewozik is a television critic for Time magazine and a viewer of 24. He agrees that the series manages to mirror geopolitics in startling ways, particularly this week.
A couple things struck me as really sort of jarringly real. One was a scene where we see one of the agents interrogating terrorists and makes reference to other people eventually getting the truth out of him, quote-unquote, at Guantanamo.
Whatever you don't tell me, you'll tell the interrogators in Guantanamo under much less comfortable circumstances. So I'll ask you one more time.
24 up to now has always taken place in this kind of make-believe parallel world. There's an intelligence agency, but it's not called the CIA. There's no reference to September 11th or something like that. So very, very jarring to hear a specifically 9/11-related proper noun coming out at us all of a sudden. The other thing I think that is very startling is suddenly to see the central debate of the show is there's been this terrorist act by a terrorist group on American soil. The question is, do we pursue that terrorist group, or do we instead fight a sort of more conventional war in which we're invading Arab countries, and does that help the war on terrorism or sidetrack us from the war on terrorism? I mean, it doesn't get much more real than that.
And then even within that, on the program, they go after such things as the nature of certain kinds of evidence. Can you trust it? Can you not trust it? Can you go to war on the basis of it? And of course, we've been watching that debate in the UN for months and months.
Exactly.
The president is going to make some very, very serious decisions based on the information that he got from that recording.
I don't want to make a mistake that our children and their children will have to pay for.
Sir, we have evidence that's been confirmed by every military and intelligence expert on the payroll.
Everyone except Jack Bauer.
So there you have it. I think what's interesting here is it points out that the military, though perhaps well-intended, is riddled with seeming spies and are also in a big rush to war. The only person that seems to be holding back in this case is the president and the independent operator, Agent Jack Bauer. This is an awfully subversive view of our government and our own, what many have criticized as a rush to war.
And the really interesting thing about that is that what is going on right now on 24, and of course this could change on a dime in a couple of episodes, but this is potentially an extremely subversive statement, unlike really just about anything that we've seen go on American TV while there are troops on the ground fighting a war in another country. It's almost analogous to the kind of real-time war coverage that we're seeing, that we're now also getting real-time dramatic responses to the world events.
And in this episode, once again, we have a reference to the fact that the enemy may go chemical. And of course, we've been hearing that in the last week or so on the news channels.
There was also a lot of discussion, for instance, of how the rest of the world is going to react, and can this lead to a world war? Can it lead to anti-Americanism?
Between the reality entertainment programs and the 24-hour news channels and the embedded reporters and the shows that cleave so closely to reality like 24, we have a sort of alternate universe that's almost indistinguishable from the real one.
And in a sense, an alternate universe, and this may be both the usefulness and the danger of a program like that, this alternate universe really gives us a more broad, synthetic image of the big picture than we're getting right now from TV news coverage of the war. In other words, on 24, we get to see what's going on behind the scenes. We get to see the different players and their motivations and agendas. It provides a big picture that, you know, we understandably can't necessarily get right now from war in Iraq.
James Poniewozik, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Brooke.
James Poniewozik is Time Magazine's TV critic and a regular viewer of 24.
Coming up, why Richard Pearl wants to go to England and why England sent us Ali G.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a key proponent of the U.S. war in Iraq stepped down from his post at the helm of the Defense Policy Board, an influential body of mainly ex-government officials that consults with the Pentagon. Richard Pearl resigned in response to a series of critical reports touched off earlier this month by a piece in The New Yorker. That story raised questions about Pearl's dealings with a pair of Saudi businessmen and suggested that he might have been trying to benefit financially from a war in Iraq. Pearl immediately went on the offensive, likening its author, Seymour Hersh, to a terrorist and threatening to sue him for libel. Now, Richard Perle is an American citizen living in America. His quarrel is with Hirsch, who also lives and works in America, but Perle plans to sue in England. Joining us to explain what is driving Perle across the ocean is David Hooper, a London lawyer who specializes in libel law. Mr. Hooper, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
First of all, tell me again how he can sue in London.
What he will say is that a number of copies of New Yorker are on sale in this country. I think it's about 10,000 as opposed to the million that are sold in the USA. But, I mean, it is quite ridiculous that he brings a claim here. Such libel as there may have been concerned Americans, conversations and events that happened anywhere other than England, either in France or in the United States. And it's straightforward libel tourism.
Before he resigned, Perle was the chairman of the Defense Policy Board and enough of a public figure to make a libel case in the United States flimsy at best. So what's the attraction of British libel law that would make him embark on this particular type of libel tourism?
Well, the real attraction would be that whereas in the States he would have to show that Seymour Hersh had deliberately published something false, which obviously he wouldn't be able to do, here he would be able to require Seymour Hersh to prove that the particular events written about were true, and the burden of proof would be on Sy.
No, this is not a new development. There have been a number of previous cases involving Americans who have taken their libel actions to British courts. How prevalent is this libel tourism?
It's pretty prevalent at the moment. I mean, the great growth industry now seems to be Russians who have come here with extremely checkered reputations.
Now, let me ask you one question. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but as long as people are suing in London for articles published overseas, that's quite a cash cow for you, is it not? If the London courts become a little more restrictive in accepting these cases, you're going to be a little disappointed?
Well, it's always said that a certain amount of crocodile tears are shed by our libel lawyers about how harsh our libel laws are. But I do defense work, and one does see firsthand the enormous problems and resources and money and time that has to go into it, because it's a serious matter for the journalist. And I mean, there are plenty of other ways we can earn our living. One of the problems one has in countries that have very harsh libel laws is that the politicians actually quite like the harsh libel laws. I'm sure there'd be a lot of American politicians who would quite like to see more curbs on the press there and for it not to be Liberty Hall. So it's quite difficult getting fundamental changes of libel laws.
Will there come a point when British jurists just say enough is enough, we really don't want to be a libel haven for American plaintiffs? Are they being more scrupulous in how they decide to handle these cases?
Well, I think it's coming that way, because the problem is that with the internet and with the greater circulation of information, I mean, everything is published everywhere. And I think there is a very strong possibility that if Richard Perle did bring an action here, that the court would just say, go back to America with it. The other thing that Mr. Perle might like to bear in mind is that the last person who sued Sy Hersh in this country came off very much second best. That was Robert Maxwell. Actually happened to be acting for Sy in that case. And in fact, Sy, in a very spirited way, counterclaimed against Maxwell, and he won on his counterclaim. And Maxwell and his company had to pay him six-figure damages for damages to Sy's reputation. Sy, of course, wouldn't have sued in the first place, but I think Mr. Perle wants to think carefully before he sues.
David Hooper, thank you very much.
Well, it's been a great pleasure.
David Hooper is a solicitor specializing in libel law. He joined us from studios in London. The The French have their Académie Française, chartered to keep their language and culture from being bastardized by outside, read, American influence. And now on the other side of the channel, some Englishmen are plotting approximately the same thing. An organization called the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom is proposing that Parliament protect British English from the vulgar Americanized version, a gambit that has attracted the attention of a previously indifferent British press to the larger issue of foreign ownership of British television stations. Joining us now is Granville Williams, spokesman for the Media Watchdog organization. Mr. Williams, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Welcome.
Give me some examples, please, of some British usage that has been defiled by, you know, Yankee impurities.
Your emergency number in the States, mm-hmm. you'd phone 911, your emergency phone number. In England, it's 999. And if children in the junior schools, in the primary schools in England, if you ask them what the emergency number is, some of them will say 911. So that's one example. But there are lots of other words which are becoming more current in the UK. I mean, take, for example, the word movies. You go to the movies, we go to see a film. But that word is becoming more prevalent. Barman and bartender, chips and fries. Different examples of the way that words are used. And I'm not suggesting these are going to bring the end of civilization as we know it. But what we're trying to do in the campaign is make a point.
We're discussing here, in the end, cultural imperialism, which is insidious partly because the victims of cultural imperialism usually welcome the invading forces with open arms. Can you really legislate against that?
Cultural imperialism might be a red herring in this debate. It's really about how you seek to protect your structures of ownership in the media and in television to reflect what we do think is important in England, which is that it should reflect back on the identity, the views, the accents, the experiences, and the language. That's part of it, which people use in their everyday life. And I'm afraid a lot of Americanisms are not the natural language that people use in their everyday life.
Aren't there remedies far less draconian than legislating the content of television programs, especially when the organization is called the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom? There's a little irony in that, isn't there?
Well, again, this is a good example of how words take on different meaning. But in some cases, and this is a particular one, we felt we needed to stimulate a discussion about what's actually happening in the ownership proposals and the proposals on regulation for the communications bill.
But the enemy here is not Americanisms. The enemy here isn't elevator instead of lift or a truck instead of lorry. Isn't there some danger of misdirection here?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a point that did worry me when we decided to put this story to the media. One of the members of the campaign works in public relations. And we had a discussion amongst the members to say, look, we've got to get some media attention. This communication bill isn't getting any headlines in the media. And this colleague, this member in the campaign, said, well, look, you know, there's always certain things you can use to try and generate interest. But you're absolutely right. The key issue that concerns us in the campaign is the content of the communications bill. And what we've tried to do is to try and interest and attract attention in the media.
So this little gimmick worked.
I think it's worked.
Well, I wish you best of luck in your real effort. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, pleasure.
Granville Williams is the spokesman for the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word. Is books part of the media?
Absolutely.
What is the point of them? I mean, I ain't done this, but has any of you actually ever read a book?
Oh, of course.
No. I was talking about the old thing.
This weekend marks the last episode in HBO's comedy series, The Ali G Show. Played by British comic Sacha Baron Cohen, Ali G is an East End would-be hip-hop star of apparently Indian extraction, who interviews such famous guests as C. Everett Koop and former U.N. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, none of whom realize that he's a fake and that they are being played for chumps. The resulting conversations for 2 years in the U.K. and the past 6 weeks here are cruel and hilarious. Witness this exchange with General Brent Scowcroft, former National Security Advisor for Presidents Ford and Bush.
Did they ever catch the people that sent Tampax through the post?
No, they did not. It wasn't Tampax, it was anthrax.
All right, I think there's different brand names. Like we say pavement, you say sidewalk, whatever.
Yo, yo, my very special guest is my man Dan Mazur, producer and co-writer of the Ali G Show. Dan, welcome to the OTM Show.
I love the yo-yo and OTM show. That's very special. You've made me feel very welcome. Thank you.
From previous interviews that you've given to the press, it's pretty obvious that you don't like to give away the secret of how in the world you actually get these people to come on the show, which leads me to the following question. How in the world do you get people to come onto your show?
Which leads me to the following answer. I refer you to my previous comments in other publications to the tune of David Blaine doesn't tell you how he levitates, David Copperfield doesn't tell you how he managed to sleep with Claudia Schiffer, so therefore I will not tell you, repeat not
All
tell
right.
you how we managed
Fair
to get
enough,
to
but tell me this.
Yes.
Do you lie?
No. No, no, no. We're not allowed to. Legally, we're not allowed to lie.
So it,
but I may be lying in telling you that I don't lie. what do you think of that? It's a riddle inside an enigma.
Encased in an obfuscation.
Yes.
I'm just curious, how long did it take before people in the United Kingdom began to be familiar enough with Ali G that they stopped agreeing to be interviewed by him?
I think probably if we wanted to go and interview people now, we could find people who still would be interviewed. Having said that, we stopped really after about 2 years, by which time the Queen Mother was saying Booyaka Shah at the Christmas lunch of the royal family, and we thought maybe we've penetrated too far into the echelons of the upper classes here to get away with it anymore.
How long do you think you can play out the string here before it's just impossible to fool anybody?
God, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's going to get more difficult. And, you know, I think if we try to get George Bush now, we might encounter some problems. But I think there are enough kind of older people without PR machines around them. That's why we tend to go for the kind of ex-politicians as opposed to the current serving politicians who would be able to sneak through the net. Although, of course, doing interviews like this doesn't necessarily help.
At the heart of all of this, there may be a principle at stake. Certainly, we frown when intelligence agencies or police agencies present themselves as journalists in order to do their work. Is there something journalistically destabilizing about Ali G posing as a journalist?
Destabilizing to who?
To actual journalists who really have to go out there and get interviews in order to do their jobs.
I don't think so, for a number of reasons, primarily because I think we do a genuine journalistic job, bizarrely, and a lot of the answers that we get out of politicians and public figures are more honest, truthful, and insightful than quote-unquote real journalists who go out there and ask their questions by rote and pose predictable questions all the time. For example, we had an interview with a politician called Tony Benn. And
the man who went to Baghdad to interview Saddam Hussein.
Exactly right, yes. Beat Dan rather to the punch. And after our interview, you know, we sat in there with him for 2 hours. We asked him questions like, is it called the welfare state because it's welfare? We had a long argument over calling women bitches, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the interview, he said that was the most kind of thorough, far-reaching interview that I've had in the last 20 years. And he got his viewpoint across to young people as he wanted to get it across. So from that point of view, I think when Ali G is at its best, it fulfills a vague journalistic function.
Does Ali G ultimately stand for anything?
I think actually he does. And, you know, I think that's what distinguishes us from, say, Tom Green or Jackass or Candid Camera or whatever, is that we try and challenge the authority and we try to kind of prick the bubble of pompousness. And we try, behind a very thick veil, I must admit, of stupidity, to have a kernel of intelligence there somewhere.
All right. What's the greatest moment in Ali G's history?
I'm now going to utterly contradict what I've just said. My favorite moment, we have a science discussion and we accuse a creationist of not flushing the loo backstage.
Was it you?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
No one's talking about.
No, I have no clue.
The floater. Is you the one backstage that didn't flush?
No, sir.
You know what I'm talking about, because the...
If that's what you're talking about,
you know,
why you would talk about that on a TV program blows my mind.
A huge argument ensues in the middle of a TV studio during a live recording with three other panelists around him.
All right, one quick follow-up. What the hell is the matter with you people?
I don't know. That was a wild card, which is probably why I like it most, because after about 5 months of solidly writing Ali G material, it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning in some godforsaken motel in the middle of Alabama, and we thought, okay, let's just throw this one into the mix, and we did, and I personally love the poo joke.
Yo yo, Dan Mazur is the producer and co-writer of the Ali G Show. He joins us from the BBC studios in London.
Big up yourselves.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Mark Herz and Emily Ford. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Does all of us really have bones, or is it just what the media want us to believe?
You all have bones.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bydell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.